Okay, let's open to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. We'll start reading in verse number 1 once again. There is, therefore, now no condemnation to them which are in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus hath made me free from the law of sin and death. For what the law could not do, and that it was weak through the flesh, God sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin, condemned sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. So then, they that are in the flesh cannot please God. But ye are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if so be that the Spirit of God dwell in you. Now if any man have not the Spirit of Christ, he is none of his. Now, last time we got together, we were considering verse number 4, and we'll do that once again. Once again, Romans chapter 8 is about God's condemnation of sin in the flesh. And so in Romans chapter 8, then in verse number 4, we read the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. Now, at first glance here, it might look like that Jesus Christ fulfilled the law in us, the law of Moses, and so therefore we're vindicated from the law because he vicariously kept the law within us. No, it doesn't mean that at all, although many do teach that. That's a false teaching. We're not saved by vicarious law keeping. In other words, somebody else keeping the law on our behalf. And that's easy enough if you just use a little common sense to think about it. If I break the law and I'm hailed into court and somebody else comes along and says, I'll tell you what, I'll go out and keep that law for him, and so therefore you can exonerate this one that's broken the law. How far do you think that would fly in a court of law? No, it wouldn't go very far at all. So it's not talking about that at all. So back to the first point that on the slide here, we're not talking about the righteousness of God being fulfilled. He's already righteous. But verse number 4 speaks about God's righteous demand that man be righteous before him. I think we've heard throughout all of our Christian lives that God can't have sin in His presence because He's holy. That's true. And so, when Adam sinned in the Garden of Eden, and Adam was the head of a whole race, and Adam was separated from God, what happened to the whole race? It was all separated from God because God can't have sin in His presence. Well, he made a way of approach for man, and it's only through the blood of a sacrifice, and so we see all of the laws that were set up in the book of Leviticus. But the problem is that the blood of goats and bulls couldn't take away sin any more than they could take away individual acts of sin. And still, it was a way of approach to God, but God said, be ye holy, for I am holy. Last time we got together, we did look at Leviticus 19 and verse number 2. So let's go there and quickly look at that, and then we'll go to the book of Amos. Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 19. And verse number 2. Point is made. Speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. What's going to turn out to be a problem with this? Interesting. This is in the book of the law, Leviticus. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy. Were the Israelites ever holy? No, they certainly weren't. See, this is the problem. God commands that man be holy before him to be acceptable in his presence, but man isn't holy. His nature is unholy. His nature is depraved and sinful, and that depraved and sinful nature works out individual acts of sin. And so God has told the Israelites something that they, as men in the flesh, cannot do. So what do you think God's object is here? Why do you suppose he would do a thing like this? It's almost like he's setting them up to fail. Do you think that God knew that they couldn't do this? So why would he tell them that they had to? He was, but they didn't know that at the time. But if they'd have been smart, what would they have done? If they'd have been smart, they'd have said, hey, we can't do this. We can't be holy because we're unholy and we're unrighteous. Remember all that stuff that happened out in the 40 years of wandering in the desert? They couldn't be holy because their nature was unrighteous and their nature was depraved. God was telling them to do something, but they couldn't do it. So what you think that they should have said at the foot of Sinai when Moses came down with the two tables of stone and they took a gander at it? If they'd have been smart, what would they have said?
Tell us now, we can't do this.
Yes, exactly right. So in Leviticus 19 and verse number 2, if they'd have been smart, what should they have said? It almost seems like God's being unreasonable and telling them to do something that they can't do, but what did God really want of them? What does God just require of any human being? Faith, but where do they get it and how? It's the R word. The R word before righteousness is possible. Repentance. When God called out to Adam in the Garden of Eden, Adam, where art thou? If Adam had been smart, what would he have said?
I messed up.
Yes. I'm hiding under these trees because I'm naked, and I was really afraid you were going to show up this afternoon, and I'm sorry. Did you ever wonder why he didn't?
Right.
Yeah. Where did that come from? See, his nature fell when he sinned. The pride wouldn't have been an issue before the fall when he was innocent. His whole nature now has changed. He's fallen spiritually, and that his spirit is disconnected from its life source. He's spiritually dead. His soul is dead now because he doesn't have the spirit to guide the soul. And sadly, his body is dead too, because now it's become the seat of that nature. And so when God shows up on the scene, Adam, where are you? What does he do? He acts like a fallen human being. He doesn't act like an innocent human being anymore. Oops. Well, why is that so important? Well, let's take a look at Amos chapter 3 and see what God has to say about that. Amos chapter 3, and we'll start reading in verse number 1. Amos chapter 3 and verse number 1. Hear this word of the Lord, hear this word that the Lord hath spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up from the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. Verse number 3, the key. Can two walk together except they be agreed? You always knew that was in the Bible. Well, now you know where to find it. Can two walk together except they be agreed? Well, what's God saying here in verse number 3? Can two walk together except they be agreed? He's laid his case out in verses 1 and 2. So what's he saying in verse number 3? Of course. How can we walk together if you are sinful and unholy, and I, the Lord, am holy and righteous and just? How can there possibly be any comport between those two? There can't be. So this is the whole problem. This is why, when Adam and Eve were driven out of the Garden of Eden, they could only approach God in a particular way. What was that particular way? God could have cut himself off completely, because they certainly weren't agreed. What were the first words out of Adam's mouth when God said, what is this that you've done? Of course, he said, the woman that you gave me, you set me up to fail. Wow, what an attitude shift from a few seconds before he fell. She was a helpmeet for him. Why did he do what he did? Just to show you how great the chasm is here between righteousness and unrighteousness. Why did Adam follow her? Did he have to do that? When Eve said, hey, have a bite. If he'd have been smart, what would he have done? He would have done exactly what he did do. Do you think that he knew what he was doing when he did it? He went into that with both eyes wide open. He sacrificed himself so he wouldn't be separated from her. He knew that she had sinned against God, and God said, in the day that you eat of it, you'll surely die separated. He wasn't willing to give her up. He died for her in a garden. Was that pregnant with suggestion? Sure was. But you see, a problem came in is after he died for her and he fell, what did he immediately begin to think of her after that? He immediately throws her off the bus. In modern parlance, that's it. See what a huge change there is? This whole thing just turns on a dime. Now Adam is estranged from God. Why can't they walk together anymore? Well, because they're not in agreement. It isn't like calling unto like. When God made Eve for Adam, how did he make her? He made her out of Adam. When God made Adam, how did he make him? He made him out of himself. He breathed himself into the nostrils of Adam, and Adam became a living soul. See how this is all connected? What happens when we break that critical link? There's no more agreement. Now Adam and Eve are both separated from God, and they can't walk with God anymore because their basic moral constitution is unholiness and unrighteousness. God can't walk with that anymore, and he would have been perfectly righteous in closing the book right at that point. Now, it's obvious that Adam didn't love God by the answer that he gave. God, you set me up by giving me this woman. Does that sound like something we just got done reading in Romans chapter 8, something about the natural mind and its disposition towards God? The natural mind is the enemy of God. Where did it get started? Clear back there in the Garden of Eden. It's been that way for the whole race all along. God would have been perfectly righteous in closing the book, not just the chapter, but the entire book, and going about his business and starting something anew. Except the plans and purposes of God are inexorable. What does that mean? I know it's one of those theological words, but you should know what it means. Inexorable. Because he's all-powerful, because he's omniscient, his will most certainly be brought to pass. Nothing's going to stand in its way. And so when he created Adam in the Garden of Eden, do you think he intended to do it? Do you think he's going to be foiled in his purpose? No, he certainly isn't. It's going to take thousands of years to work out his plan and purpose, but he's not going to be foiled. And two walk together, except they be agreed. What's the problem then with God and fallen man? They can't walk together because they're not agreed. Well, why did God give the children of Israel the law then? We just went back to the book of the law. That's what Leviticus is. And we found that verse number 2 in chapter 19 where God tells the children of Israel to be holy because he's holy. Let's keep that thought in mind and go back to the Garden of Eden and the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, where I said a moment ago God could have closed the book at that point, but he didn't. He offered a glimmer of hope. Even before they were driven out of the garden, he offered a glimmer of hope. What was that? It's another one of those theological words, the protevangelium. The evangelism that goes before. I don't do that Spanish lingo. Pardon? Yes, he told Eve that of the seed of the woman, he would raise up a deliverer, not of the seed of Adam, but of the seed of the woman. That's important, and not seeds as of many, but seed as of one. We learn in the New Testament that he was speaking of Christ, his only begotten Son, who took upon himself human form, human nature, without the sin nature. There's nothing wrong with a human nature, but there's plenty wrong with a sin nature. That's where the problem arises. And so God gave them that glimmer of hope, and then after they were driven out of the garden, did God have any further contact with man? He gave them the skins, but that was before they were driven out of the garden. Of course, the skins represented something, and we know what that was. But after they were driven out of the garden, did God say, okay, go make your way in the world. It's going to be tough, but you made your bed. Now you get to sleep in it. Well, he did, but you're not thinking of the world's first murder? That's so sensational. I'll bet that made the New York Times. Oh, wait. Can you imagine the New York Times headlines? God unrighteous. What did he do? What was the point of contention between Cain and Abel? Wasn't it how to worship God? How to approach God? So much for vegetarianism. What was the way to approach God? Through the shed blood of a sacrifice. Abel was right. So God didn't completely cut man off, but he sure sent some broad hints back there, didn't he? If you want to approach me, there's only one way that it can be done. Innocent blood must be shed. That goes clear back to the Garden of Eden. But there's a little problem with lambkins and Bambi. Guess they didn't use Bambis. Disney hadn't been invented yet. No, because it's the blood of goats and bulls that can't take away sin, because like has to call unto like. It's going to require an innocent human sacrifice to pay the price. But if the price for individual acts of sin is taken care of, and by the way, when Eve sinned in the Garden of Eden, did she sin by committing an overt act that was wrong? You gotta say yes. But was she compelled to do it by her nature? No. Her nature was innocent. Her nature had no power to compel her to do what she did. But she was deceived by the serpent. Let's fast forward a few minutes to Adam. Did he have to do what he did? No, he committed an overt act of sin. He had his reasons for doing it, as we said a moment ago. But as soon as he did it, what happened to his nature? The overt act of sin corrupted his nature. So let's go outside the garden and talk about Cain just for a moment. Cain is going to commit an overt act because murder is probably a bad thing. This was before the law, so I'm sure a good lawyer could have gotten him off. No. Do you think Cain knew it was wrong to murder his brother? Of course he did. The law was already written on the conscience of man, but he committed an overt act. Now, the question becomes, why did he do it, and did he more or less have to?
It was his nature to do it.
Of course it was his nature to do it. All he did was act on his corrupt nature. So see how it gets reversed from what happened with Adam and Eve? They committed an overt act of sin which corrupted their nature, but then they passed on the corrupt nature to everybody that's in the world, and now that corrupt nature rules in the life of man. Isn't that what Paul was struggling against in Romans chapter 7? His corrupt nature was enticing, only enticing, but enticing him to do acts of evil? It's the same thing. Only we have something that a lost person doesn't have. What's that?
The Spirit of God living within us.
Do you think that the Spirit of God living within us could stop the source of the evil or pull its fangs? Remember that body of sin that was destroyed that we talked about back in chapter 6, and I said that's a really bad translation. Do you remember that? The body of sin was destroyed so that we wouldn't be forced to serve sin? No. What did the Weymouth say about that verse? Its power was removed. The power of the old nature is now removed. It's still there, and it still does what it always has done, but now it can't force us to do anything. And I said last time we got together that there's a difference between being in the Spirit and walking in the Spirit. That's going to get kind of valuable as we move on in chapter 8. If you're saved, you're in the Spirit. But you may not be walking in the Spirit. More of that later. Let's move on to the next point then, shall we? How can two walk together except they be agreed? Psalm 119 and verse 96. Psalm 119 and verse number 96. You know, I got a feeling that poor old Paul had read this verse as he was wallowing around in the Slough of Despond in chapter 7. Psalm 119, verse number 96. I have seen an end of all perfection, but thy commandment is exceeding broad. What does that mean? Some people think, I just keep the Ten Commandments, I'm good. That rich young ruler that met Jesus, hey, I've kept all those commandments from my youth up. Wait a minute. Not so quick there. I've talked about Jimmy Carter and how the media, which you'd have thought had been friendly to the peanut farmer, nailed him down on one of the commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Apparently, even the devil has theologians, because his minions, the media, asked Carter the question, well, have you ever thought about it? What did poor old Jimmy say? Might have been the only truth he ever told. Yeah, I thought about it. Well, then you've already done it. But see, a legalist always looks at the law of God in a very narrow sense. Are they any different than Bob Ingersoll? That famous anti-Christ, anti-God, idiot savant who was found sitting around reading a copy of the Bible, and his friend says, what in the world are you doing, Bob? He says, looking for a loophole. Isn't that just like a legalist to look at everything in a very narrow sense? And they say, if I keep this rule, and I keep that rule, and I keep this other rule, I'm good. See, the problem is that there's 700 and some odd commandments in the Old Testament. It isn't just 10. Not only would a person have to keep all of the moral law, he'd have to keep all of the ceremonial law and know what he's doing in the keeping of the ceremonial law in order to keep it. How good a multitasker are you? I'm not that good. I'm a terrible multitasker. The truth of the matter is nobody's a multitasker. The ones that think they are just do a whole lot of tasks very inefficiently. Computers are multitaskers. There's some truth to linear Western thought. We can't hold more than one thought in our mind at a given time. What does that tell you about those 700 and some odd rules and regulations? Thy commandment is exceeding broad. That rich young ruler said, you know, I kept those 10 commandments. Jesus didn't even bring up something arcane, if you will. Not that there's anything arcane in God's law, but something that's way off the beaten path. Like, what meaneth these stones? He stayed right on the 10 commandments. Oh, I've kept all of those. No, wait a minute. You're Jimmy Carter's great, 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 great grandpa. He went away sorrowful because he had great possessions. How can two walk together except they be agreed? Doesn't the scripture say in another place that anybody that fails on any point of the law is guilty of the whole thing? When you get a traffic ticket and you're hailed into court and the judge says, that'll be $700, please. Inflation, you know. Do you think that telling him, but Mr. Judge, I've been driving 40 years and this is the first ticket I ever got. The judge is going to say, well, I guess in a case like that. No, it doesn't work that way. Just because you did everything else right, and you did everything else right for a very long time, does not negate the fact that you're here, charged with this, guilty of the whole law. How can two walk together except they be agreed? They can't. And unless God decides to do something about it himself, man is stuck because he can't change his nature. He can't lift himself up by his own bootstraps. Sunk. Has to come from outside. If there's any solution to the problem, God's going to have it, and he's going to be willing to apply it. Well, he has a solution, and he has applied it. And it's a wonderful thing if we understand all of the things concerned with how that works. And we have the Lord's table in front of us, which takes us right back to the foundational fact. And since we're in Romans chapter 8, if forgiveness for sins were the only thing in sight, why are we having bread? As you bow your heads and think about that, I'll ask Brother Casey to come and give me a hand.